Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to begin by first thanking Morton and the entire team at SILRAP for bringing us together in this place on these important discussions. I also want to acknowledge that it's a privilege to be here with all of you. There are many, many distinguished scholars and practitioners gathered here, and as somebody who spends most of her time focused on the causes, consequences, and termination of civil wars, it's been a nice change of scenery and really intellectually stimulating. Today, my talk focuses on agency, authority, and autonomy, the role and impact of interactions with transnational civil society actors on the ICC's operations. I want to preface my talk by first mentioning that this is a work in progress, and so I would welcome your feedback and suggestions on the substance and form of what I will present on. I also feel that I must acknowledge that while this is an understudied, under-researched area, one of the few people who's really written quite a lot about this is in the room, and it's Kirsty, so I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge her presence. As you all know, a lot has been written about the role of non-governmental organizations and civil society actors in getting to the Rome Statute, but much less has actually been written and investigated and analyzed about sort of what's happened in the last 15 years since the court began its operations. Non-governmental civil society organizations, both nationally and transnationally, not only pushed for the creation of the ICC, as I mentioned, but they played crucial roles in framing the statute and setting its scope. Marlies Glasius describes the adoption of the statute as a global civil society achievement. So it's not surprising that transnational civil society organizations have continued to play very important roles in the last 15 years. And indeed, transnational civil society progressively plays a salient role in global governance. With respect to the ICC, as I mentioned, many scholars have touched on this issue in getting to it. So my study is motivated by two questions. First, in what ways and to what end do transnational civil society actors generate and exercise power in engaging with the International Criminal Court? And second, what are the modes, mechanisms, and motivations that drive transnational civil society interactions with the court? In seeking to answer these questions, my paper does three things. First, it offers a relevant conceptualization of power. Second, it examines the agency of transnational civil society vis-a-vis the court. And third, it analyzes the impact of transnational civil society interactions on the operations of the court, with a particular focus on authority and autonomy, and I'll talk about those more in a moment. Through a combination of qualitative research methods, I show that transnational civil society wields considerable power and influence in its interactions with the court. Understanding the nature of this power, including its contours and limits, is essential to advancing scholarship on how justice is conceptualized and administered, laws are institutionalized, and the international legal system related to human rights protection is fortified. I argue that transnational civil society groups exercise normative and discursive agency through a variety of strategies to produce and influence the ICC's functions. I find that one, while unlikely and unable to compel the ICC to act in accordance with their wishes, transnational civil society groups continue to have authority and wield power through agenda setting and technical expertise and a platform for moral accountability. They play important roles in facilitating coordination and cooperation between the ICC, states, and other international organizations, not only in the furtherance of investigations and prosecutions, but also during times when the court is subject of heavy criticism and skepticism. I also show that transnational civil society organizations strive to maintain their own autonomy and resist becoming instruments of the ICC or the state parties of the Rome Statute. Before delving into this further, allow me to briefly offer some conceptual clarification. And over the course of this conference, several individuals have stepped up here and cited many scholars and frameworks about how to think about these. So as you all know, power is a contested concept in international politics, so I'll focus on the interpretations that apply here. First, I draw on Stephen Luke's theory on power and his argument that power and its effectiveness is a function of three key dimensions. Two are actually important for my analysis. The first is issue, and the second is agenda. Issue refers to the traditional notion of power as the relationship between people and the interaction through which some actors directly modifies the behavior of others. The second dimension, in contrast, relates to agenda setting and shaping, which are important sources of power, as I show. These help explain the interactions between transnational civil society and the ICC. I also draw on Michael Barnett and Robert Duvall's definition of power as, and I quote, "the production in and through social relations of effects that shape the capacities of actors to determine their circumstances and fate." Barnett and Duvall offer a taxonomy of power with four types being compulsory, institutional, structural, and productive. This typology is well suited to my analysis because it shows that power can be expressed both through interactions between actors and constitutively. For the purposes of my paper, it's important to distinguish between power in, power over, and power to. So the power in the relationship between transnational civil society and the ICC should be examined in both rationalist and constructivist terms, whereas the former concerns strategies, constraints, incentives, institutions, and rules. The latter emphasizes social relations, norms, and intersubjective understandings of actors and their interactions. So it's important to understand power from the perspective of individuals who occupy and act on behalf of these structures because they give life to power and how it's perceived, dispensed, received, and produced in international criminal justice. Power is also closely related to influence, and one way to think about influence is that it manifests when advice is followed as a result of recognizing the influencer's competence. Now on transnational civil society. While a host of third-party actors exercise power in international criminal justice, my scope is limited to the role of transnational civil society and its relationship to the ICC. Richard Price defines transnational civil society as, and I quote, "a set of interactions among an imagined community to shape collective life that are not confined to territorial and institutional spaces of states," end quote. Relatedly, Florini conceptualizes organizations that operate transnationally as, and I quote, "self-organized advocacy groups that undertake voluntary collective action within action across state borders in pursuit of what they deem to be the wider public interest." It's important to note, however, from the outset that when I talk about transnational civil society, this is not a homogeneous category of actors. Far from it, groups take on many forms, sizes, orientations, and preferences. While some focus on the ICC as one programmatic area, others' very mission revolves around the court. But those that are covered in my study have two key dimensions. First, they are transnational in their structure and objectives. And second, they believe in the mission of the ICC and support its existence, even if critical of it. Transnational civil society organizations studied here are also generally liberal in their political orientation in that they believe in and support the protection of universal human rights. They include, for example, the International Federation of Human Rights, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Redress, Women's Initiatives for Global Justice, Global Gender Justice, Parliamentarians for Global Action, the International Center for Transnational Justice, and the International Bar Association. And as part of the research for this, I conducted semi-structured interviews with representatives of many of those organizations and others. In addition, the scope of the essay covers transnational civil society networks and coalitions, most notably the Coalition for the International Criminal Court. The CICC, as I'm sure all of you know, was established to consolidate information, talent, energy, and expertise towards the creation of the ICC. And while it was originally comprised of approximately 25 organizations, today it constitutes amongst its members some 2,500 local and international organizations that focus on the work of the ICC. And the growth of the CICC, in my opinion, is indicative of the salience of transnational activism in international criminal justice. Indeed, the CICC's continued relevance demonstrates that transnational advocacy organizations and networks have critical roles to play in not only the emergence and adoption of human rights norms, but also their internalization and institutionalization. As a network, the CICC is a communicative structure, and they not only serve as tools and instruments, but also can constitute dynamic processes. The coalition structure of the CICC allows it at once to draw on the individual expertise of its members, but at the same time to work collectively to monitor the court, relay information to and from members, and rally global support for international criminal justice broadly. So in acting as a formal network, the CICC is able to solidify ties between member organizations. It also facilitates cooperation in order to overcome collective action dilemmas that are faced by individual organizations. So allow me now to focus briefly on the first pillar of my paper, which relates to agency. Since the court opened its doors, transnational civil society groups have actively continued to interact with the court by raising public awareness about it, providing technical assistance and information, acting as a bridge between the court and victims and witnesses, lobbying the court to carry out investigations, monitoring the court's operations and outreach, and other related functions. In pursuing a range of interactive professional activities that straddle both public and private spheres, transnational civil society organizations seek to get issues on the ICC's agenda, as well as change institutional policies, procedures, and behavior. Transnational civil society also seeks to change the broader international political environment within which the ICC operates, and in doing so, shape structures of meaning and power. Personal networks are crucial to maintaining contact and applying pressure on court officials. One interviewee explained to me, and I quote, "We have enormous access from working level to coordinate a mission on focus on a special issue all the way to the very top. The constant fluid interaction is sometimes formal and sometimes very informal. Groups frequently strategize on how, when, and why they can work together to influence the court in order to achieve common goals." Describing a philosophy of stronger together, another interviewee explained, "Even if there is competition over resources or attention, we do work closely. We have to rely on each other and support one another." I'm not sure what's happening there. I apologize with the superimposing of my slides. Anyway. So my research reveals that transnational civil society organizations employ a dual strategy that balances a pragmatic internal strategy with a principled external strategy. Representatives of groups interviewed described a constant calculus between hardline insistence and middle ground compromise that characterizes their activism. Put another way, transnational civil society organizations play a good cop, bad cop role. In this sense, individual groups and coalitions have the capacity to mobilize public opinion at the international and national levels in favor of and against the court. And as I explain next, this is inseparable from how we think of authority. So authority, stemming from expertise, moral grounding, and credibility, is a key source of influence for transnational civil society organizations, and it is produced and reproduced through social relations. In order to have impacts that bring about change, whether procedural, structural, and cultural, in ICC operations, transnational organizations, civil society organizations have to be perceived as credible and legitimate by the court, as well as other relevant stakeholders, including state parties. Being credible denotes qualities such as trustworthiness and authenticity, whereas being legitimate means that they are accepted as stakeholders whose views, activities, and expectations matter. The credibility and legitimacy of transnational civil society organizations is closely tied to their respective mission, vision, and mandate, and this in turn produces the authority that is crucial to the nature of their power and influence vis-a-vis the court. As the court has grown and matured in the last 15 years, a sociological approach to understanding legitimacy, according to David Beetham, concerns, and I quote, whether power is acknowledged as right, appropriate, or just by relevant agents, such as power holders and their staff, those subject to power, or third parties whose support or recognition may help confirm it. Transnational civil society organizations stake a claim on moral authority in international criminal justice by positioning itself as committed to public, not private, interests that enhance the quote-unquote common good. Still, these organizations dedicated to the protection and promotion of human rights draw on other forms of authority, too, in their interactions with the court, including, according to Kirsty Lone, delegated expert and political sources. She refers to, in her scholarship, a number of dimensions that essentially endow transnational civil society organizations with what she calls expert authority, these being a revolving door where professionals move between the court, academia, lawyering, and advocacy, and in doing so demonstrate commitment, long-term commitment, to spreading international criminal justice globally. In addition, gathering, processing, and sharing information through different networks and channels of communication. Now, one key example that multiple interviewees cited was the development of new institutional policies and guidelines to improve the court's internal functions and external profile. And an example I'll cite here that actually speaks to an earlier presentation today was the development of the ICC's policy paper on sexual and gender-based crimes. From 2012 to 2016, the ICC prosecutor appointed the leader of a transnational civil society organization based in The Hague to serve as special advisor on gender in a pro bono capacity, and in that role, she helped to co-write this policy paper. Several interviewees cited this policy paper as one of the most important achievements of collaboration between the court and civil society. And I should acknowledge, or I should note, that opinion was shared amongst interviewees who are in civil society as well as those who are within the office of the prosecutor within the court. Transnational civil society organizations not only lobbied for this policy, but were also able to exercise agency through an interactive process to shape its content. In doing so, civil society organizations that directly or indirectly participated in the development of the policy drew on the individual expertise and collective authority to influence the court's decision making. The court saw transnational civil society organizations as a powerful ally and credible partner whose inputs would enhance the court's capacity and record for gender analysis. Building off this and parallel to the work, transnational civil society experts have also engaged ICC officials on a policy related to the protection of children's rights and worked for years to improve provisions on victims' protection. But at the same time, there are some issues, such as the policy on case selection and decision-making on initiating preliminary examinations, where transnational civil society organizations have not made similar inroads. And I think it's very important to pay attention to how that is and why that is the case. And so over the course of the court's lifespan, as it has grown and matured, so too has the relationship between transnational civil society. The constant and repeated interactions that characterize the relationship between the court, the CIC, and the CICC present important challenges and opportunities, including with respect to autonomy of these organizations. But before I speak about autonomy, I wanted to share this quote, which I think sort of encapsulates the type of thing that I heard over and over again. So one interviewee said, "Our authority comes from research and documentation on the ground. Long before the ICC has been involved, we've been there monitoring the overall situation as well as specific instances that are of interest to the court." So authority and expertise are inseparable. Also, our authority comes from effectiveness. The court knows our recommendations come from our principles and our knowledge of substance and the process of justice. I'll skip over this, but there are a few more vignettes. Allow me to jump in really briefly in my time that I have left to talk about issues of autonomy. One of the areas where this manifests most in one of the most complicated ways relates to the budgeting of the court and fundraising for the court. As I mentioned earlier, civil society groups often are engaged in criticizing the court and in pushing back against the court and being able to shape public opinion, but another role that they play relates to the fundraising. And this happens in formal meetings, in Chatham House Roll meetings, in informal meetings, in corridors, but also at the annual Assembly of State or at the Assembly of State Parties meetings. And what was interesting to me was that some organizations categorically said that they would not play a role in this. Many others said that while they were happy to, they felt that the court oftentimes tried to instrumentalize NGOs, and this can make them feel very uncomfortable and as though they're becoming sort of instruments of state parties or instruments of the court itself. At the same time, in trying to help fundraise for the court, some organizations cited the fact that they were often treated as cheerleaders of the court by donor countries and felt that, their autonomy was being pushed back on sort of both sides, if you will. This sort of speaks to this tension, if you will, where civil society actors have power and influence, but they also feel like their autonomy is infringed on and they have to sort of work to reproduce it. I'm cognizant of time, so I'll just very quickly conclude to say that, and I'm happy to talk about some other activities, including public outreach and issues there, but on this budgeting question, one of the people I interviewed said, and I quote, "The budget process is strangling the court, which leaves its staff with an attitude of resignation about what is achievable." And this, in turn, has ripple effects on transnational civil society that provide expertise, partner, and outreach to the court. But we also recognize that state parties are unwilling to increase the court's budget, meaning that we have to step up and help out on non-judicial functions. So as we think about the relationship between third-party actors and specifically transnational civil society actors, I think it's important to also consider, it's important to consider and scrutinize, who is holding transnational civil society actors accountable? Who are they responsible to? Is it the donors who fuel their work? Is it the court? Is it the constituents that they claim to represent? It's probably a combination of a factor of those, but we need a lot more scholarship and scrutiny on these questions. So I will wrap up there, but I'm happy to sort of answer questions and look forward to your feedback. As I mentioned, to I think some of you, this project is not representative of the majority of my work on transitional justice. My first book was on women in transitional justice with a focus on Kenya, where I had worked for the Kenya Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission and Bangladesh and the International Crimes Tribunal there. And so my work has actually often been about the negotiations around transitional justice and on victims' participation in those processes. So it was wonderful to be able to get into this area of research and sort of learn more about it and try to contribute knowledge to it. But I'm continuing to write and to collect data on this. I've done dozens of interviews, but I'm continuing to do more. So I look forward to your comments on how to sort of bring this contribution together with some of the other themes that we've covered today. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.